I will be reading from the book of Luke, chapter 15, verses 11 to 32, from the New Revised Standard Version. The parable of the prodigal and his brother. Then Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me.' So he divided his property between them. A few days later, the young son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant country. And there he squandered his property in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard the music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has got him back safe and sound.' Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him, but he answered his father, 'Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him.' Then the father said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found.'" Amen. And God always blesses the public reading of his inspired and his infallible word.
Luke 15 contains three stories, and each one combines to present the people that were listening to them with a choice. If you read verses 1 and 2 of the chapter that we have just heard, you discover that tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to Jesus And the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling. And they were saying, how can this fellow eat with sinners? He welcomes them. And Jesus responds to that judgmentalism, to that condescension, by telling three stories. A story about a shepherd and a sheep that gets lost in verses 1 through to 7. A story about a woman who loses a coin in verses 8 through to 10. And a story about a father who loses a son in verses 11 through to 32. And on this Father's Day in 2025, I invite you to consider with me particularly that last story, and whether you are online or here in the building, to respond to the Father who is waiting at the gate for you. These three stories are powerfully positioned by Luke as he writes about who Jesus is and why Jesus has come. He faces head on the accusation of the Pharisees and the scribes that Jesus mixes with the wrong people, that he welcomes the wrong people. And the scholar Joel Green, commenting on all of Luke chapter 15, describes it as a chapter with the title Rejoicing at the Finding of the Lost. When you look at the setting, you discover that Jesus is saying something quite profound, something moving and challenging. And it is challenging to two groups of people. It's first of all challenging to the scribes and the Pharisees who have come into the posture and the habit of believing that they can decide who comes to God's table and who does not. And their voice and their actions have had control of the Jewish people for hundreds and hundreds of years by this point. But these words are also challenging to the publicans and tax collectors or toll collectors with whom Jesus mixes. Because as he mixes with them, the scribes and the Pharisees are not happy about it. But Jesus' story, no doubt, is heard also by the publicans and the tax collectors, who hear not a story of judgment and condemnation, but an invitation, who are reminded that they are worth something, who have been told by their culture and the people around them and the religious that they're not good enough and they're not welcome or they're not wanted or they're not somehow the right type of people, but whom Jesus welcomes with open arms. In verse 2 of Luke chapter 15, we are told that Jesus listens to their grumbling. The Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling. And Jesus hears it. He understands it. He knows it. And he has something to say to them. In fact, if you will give me just a few moments of your time, you'll discover that this story, these three stories, are cocooned or sandwiched around another idea in the Gospel of Luke. And it's actually an idea that goes all the way through Luke's Gospel, and that is, who can come to your table? In Luke chapter 14 and in Luke chapter 16, Jesus has a great deal to say about the people that eat at his table. And here we find a story of a table in this journey of the son who goes away, then comes back. The father has a table set for him. Somebody's pearl has just gone right across the floor. That is the pearl of great price. I would chase after it if I were you. That could be worth thousands of pounds. I can see it. It's right there if you want to get it. Nobody's moving. I'll leave it. It's when a phone goes and you say, do you want to get that? We can wait. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. In Luke chapter 14, verse 13, here's what you read. When you have a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. In verse 21 of Luke chapter 14, you read these words. So the slave returned and reported this to his master, and the owner of the house became angry and said to his slave, go out into the streets and the lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. And the slave said, sir, what you have ordered has been done, and there is still room. And the master said to the slave, go out into the roads and the lanes and compel people to come in so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste my dinner. In other words, in this story, before the story, Jesus says, there's room at my table for all those that the Jewish people say are not good enough. The religious leaders can reject them, but there's a space at my table for them. And I want to say to you tonight, you know this, many of you, but you may not, because you might be here for the first time, or you might be joining us online for the first time. The Church of Jesus Christ exists for the outcast, the lost, the least, the last, the lonely. We exist for those who have been told by people they're not good enough. We exist for those who have never found a home spiritually because they've been judged or rejected or maligned or ridiculed or laughed at. And if we fall into the trap of being like the scribes and Pharisees and saying they're not our kind of people, be careful, because you may exclude yourself from God's banquet. You may, by your actions, determine that you are not worthy to sit at God's table. It's a powerful story. And then go forward to the chapter after the section we're looking at. I hope you do have Bibles with you if you have one. Luke chapter 16, verse 20. And we're told that in verse 19, there was a rich man, another parable, and he who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores. And once again, we see the table image. In fact, in Luke's gospel, for those of you that are interested in such things, every major decision is made by Jesus and communicated by him, either at a table, on the way to a table, or on the way from a table. Every single one. And so we come to this story. And I wonder tonight if there are women and men online or in this room, perhaps already followers of Jesus, perhaps inquiring and thinking about this faith and wanting to know more about Jesus and feeling as if you're not good enough for his table. You're not welcome at his table. Maybe a leader has told you that. I'm sorry if they have. Maybe a pastor or a preacher or a priest or a minister or a bishop or an archbishop or somebody in religious authority once said to you, you'll never fit in around here. And it sinks into your soul and into your spirit. And before you realize it, you're counting yourself out of God's table. I pray this story will remind you that God, through Jesus Christ, always makes room at his table for those who are hungry and are willing to come to him. Fundamentally, the three stories in Luke's gospel tell one single message. And it's not just about lostness. We'll come to that in a moment. It's about this. Jesus Christ has come to fulfill God's purposes. And how will we respond to that mission? Jesus has come to draw those that are excluded, to welcome the broken. And in Luke 15, at least, the focus of the three stories is on those who think they know better than Jesus. It's interesting that these three stories sit so closely together, because in Mark chapter 2, verse 17, we are told that Jesus once said this, those who are well have no need of a physician, but only those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Can I say something to you that might be alarming for you? If you think you're too righteous for Jesus, don't worry about it. You're not invited. You're not invited. He invites those who know that there is no hope anywhere else. He invites those who know that they need a Savior. So let's think about these two stories for a moment before we focus on the third. And for a moment, let's look at the first two. The story of the lost sheep in verses 1 to 7 and the story of the lost coin in verses 8 to 10. All three stories actually have five similar characteristics. Number one, they have a main character. In the first story, it is the shepherd. In the second story, it is the woman who has lost a coin. In the third story, despite people's best efforts, it is not the father. The first half of the story, the focus is on the younger brother. The second half of the story, the focus is on the elder brother. And the plea behind the story is the father. Every single one of the stories has a lost and searching, a lost and looking for story. In the first story, the shepherd has lost a sheep. In the second story, the woman has lost a coin. In the third story, the man, the father, has lost a son. Actually, to be technically more correct, the son has lost his way. Each one of them tells a recovery story. The shepherd leaves the 99 to go and find the one. The woman searches the house and finds the coin. The lost boy finds his way home. Each story has a celebration. When the sheep is found, there is rejoicing. When the coin is found, there is rejoicing. And Jesus explains that rejoicing in both stories by saying, so there is great rejoicing in heaven at one person who repents and comes home. In the third story, there is also rejoicing, but there is no concluding remark. It's very strange and it's very interesting. In the shepherd story, Jesus says, so there is rejoicing in heaven. In the coin story, so there is rejoicing in heaven. In the lost son story, Jesus pulls heaven down into the lives of the scribes and Pharisees and leaves the story hanging because he's asking them, will you rejoice when lost people come home? Or will you exclude yourself from the rejoicing by refusing to accept them? It's interesting also when you look at the characters in the story. Of course, each one at the center, the shepherd, the woman with the coin, and the father represent God. The first, a wealthy man, 99 sheep, 100 sheep, that's a wealthy shepherd. God is represented as a wealthy, middle-class, successful shepherd. The second story, he's represented as a widow or as a woman who has very little. And the third story, he's represented as a father of wealth and means who's willing to give up his reputation in order to have his boy home. And then you have the ratios. Have you ever noticed them? One sheep out of 100, but then one coin out of 10. To lose a sheep out of 100 is difficult, but it's not as catastrophic as using one coin out of 10, is it? But then the third story is one son out of 2. There's an intensification of the story as you make your way through all three. And as we approach Luke 15, verse 11, the story of the younger son who goes. Actually, you can't capture it in English, but verse 8 and 9 and 10 is all really one sentence, or 8 and 9 anyway. The story of the woman who had the coins and loses one and lights a lamp because there are no windows in her house because she is not wealthy and sweeps the house and searches carefully until she finds it. Then she rejoices and she calls together her friends and her neighbors and says, rejoice with me for I have found the coin I have lost, is all one sentence. It's one long invitation into this next story, and so we come to it on Father's Day. And when you look at it very quickly, what you discover is the concentration of this idea of son and father and son. There are three main characters. There is a younger son, there is an older son, and there is a father. God the Father is at the center of the story, searching and longing for his son who has walked away. And when you look at verse 12, you see the first mention of the father. There was a man, verse 11, who had two sons. The Pharisees and the scribes will soon realize that these two sons represent Israel and the Gentile world. Those who were counted in and those who counted everybody else out. The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me." So he divided his property between them. I want what's mine and I want it now. And the father doesn't say, no, you can't have it. He doesn't say, wait until I die. You probably don't pick up just how culturally insensitive and rude this story is already. Imagine coming to your father, even today, and saying, well, look, when you die, I'll get the house. Any chance you could give it to me now? What would you say? No. Wait. I have three sons and two daughters, and I collect various things. I collect watches, and I collect antique and nice pens. And every now and again, my boys will say, Dad, who's getting that watch? Who's getting that watch? And sometimes I say, if you ask me again, none of you are getting them. My daughters love to write, as do I. One of my sons is actually a journalist and a writer, and they'll pick up my pens when they come into my study, and they'll say, oh, I like this pen. Oh, this one's quite heavy. Dad, where's the box for this? Is there a receipt for this pen, Dad? But never once have they really meant it and said, any chance you could give this to me now, because I'm going to get it when you die anyway. That's what this young man says. And in our culture, that's rude. In that culture, it's even ruder. And the father says, okay. That's the remarkable thing. You want it, you can have it. And so he goes. And from verse 13 through to verse 16 of the story, you read that it doesn't go well. You're popular when you've got money. You're popular when you can give people around you what you want, but when the money runs out, your friends exit the door and you realize they were never friends in the first place. When he had money and influence, everybody was around him, but one by one his friends left because the dollar was being spent, until he finds himself with nothing. If you want to know who your friends are the people that stick around when everything else is gone. They're the ones that stand by you no matter what. They're the ones that say, I'm here for you, I'll love you, I'll help you. I don't know what the solution is, but I'm not going to walk away. And this young man finds himself with nothing. A Jewish boy living amongst pigs, wishing he could eat the pig feed. You can't get a worse picture. And maybe in your life, or in your life online, you've tried everything else and you've realized it's not working. Maybe as a Christian, you've had one foot in the church and one foot in the world. And you've thought, well, I can meddle, I can balance this all out. And one by one, your friends have gone. And tonight, if you're sitting listening to me here or online, you feel hollow and empty inside and you're afraid to tell anybody. Or maybe you've never known Jesus Christ. Maybe you've never thought that he loved you. Maybe you've counted yourself out. But this young fella comes to his senses. And let's read in verse 15 on. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. And he would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. What a terrible, terrible situation to be in. But when he came to himself, or when he came to his senses, or when he realized what a mess he'd made of his life, in verse 17, what does he say? How many of my father's house have bread enough and to spare? But here I am dying in hunger. I will get up and go to my father. There's father again and again. I will get up and I will go to my father and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands. He comes to the end of himself. And sometimes God allows us to come to the end of ourselves before we can see the beginning of his grace and his mercy. And maybe in your life, you've come to the end of yourself. You've tried everything else, and you realize tonight none of it has worked, but God is still there. Look at what he says in verse 20. So he set off, and he went to his father. He just wanted to get home. I just need to get to my father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and he put his arms around him and he kissed him. And then the son says everything that he had said he was going to say in verse 21. And we read in verse 22, but the father said to his slaves, bring quickly a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Every cultural norm is broken by this father. As an elder, as a respected man, you never ran. You never made the first move in relationship restoration. You never embraced publicly in this way. You never did this. You waited on somebody proving their value and their worth, even if it was your son. But in this story, this father must have been waiting somewhere every day. Waiting to see if his son would come back. How did he know it was him in the distance? Well, those of you that are aunties or uncles or parents or grandparents will know that when you hear a child cry that is connected to you, you know their cry. When our kids were growing up, often they would be in a room full of other children, and sometimes it just sounded like craziness, just loud, 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 screaming and yelling and gurning and getting on. But when you heard your child cry, you knew it was your child. I could still tell you the sound. If my daughter or my son were in this room and they started to cry, I would know it was them. Even my grandchildren. Not so long ago, I was out with one of my grandchildren. We were in a big park and everybody was playing and I heard him crying and I knew immediately it was him. Because fathers know their kids. And this man is waiting day after day. Did he know his gait? Did he know the way he walked? Did he remember something about him? What was it? How long was he away? We don't know any of that. But we know that this dad, as soon as he saw his son ran toward him. And the son didn't even get the words out. He didn't get to say, Dad, I'm sorry. The father throws his arms around him and kisses him and welcomes him back. Isn't that a beautiful picture of grace, of God's mercy? And so many people in our culture, maybe here tonight or online, you think God's waiting for you to do something. You've got a test to pass. You've got some kind of examination to prove that you're worthy or you deserve his love. And he's just waiting for you to turn to you, to turn to him. And when you turn to him, he runs to you. One of the first verses I learned as a follower of Jesus when I was converted back in 1986 was, whilst we were still sinners, Christ died for us. In this, God shows his love for us. He loved me first. He made the first move here in his love. Not that we love God, but that he loved us and gave himself as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Do you realize God has made the first move? Do you realize tonight, whoever you are, whether you're converted or you're not yet converted, that all you have to do is turn toward him? All you have to do is say, just to be intent on making that journey, and as soon as you make that step, he runs to you? All over London tonight, there'll be men and women that are struggling with Father's Day, feeling rejected, feeling abandoned, feeling failures, brokenhearted because of how they've been treated by their dads, yearning and learning, looking for hoping for a relationship someday that will fill that gulf. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a relationship available right here. Right here. Whatever you've done, wherever you've come from, there is a yearning Father right here. And he is standing, looking out across this congregation, looking out across the internet, waiting for someone to turn their attention toward him, and he will run to you. One of my big brothers, who died a few years ago, was called Edward. He had the most bizarre life. One day, I will write a book about it, honestly. In short, Edward joined the Royal Marines when he was 18, and he went absent without leave when he was 23. Him and his mate got drunk one night in Exeter and said they didn't like the Royal Marines. But the following day, his mate sobered up and went back to the Royal Marines. But Edward went missing. And the police and the army, military police, contacted my mother and father and said, "We don't know where Edward is, but he is now absent without leave. And when we find him, we will arrest him." About 3 months later, I will never forget it. I was only a little boy, a crate about the size of two old-fashioned tea chests, arrived back at our council house in Belfast. And my mother and father stood beside that crate and they broke their heart. It was like a coffin without a body. They lifted out the things that belonged to Edward. We didn't know where he was. We didn't know what had happened to him. We didn't know whether he was living or dead. It was awful. Both my mother and father went to hell and back as they tried to work out how to cope with what was going on because he was their blue-eyed boy. And a few months later, about 4 or 5 months later, we had a postcard arrive at home. And it was my brother had very scrawly handwriting. And it was a postcard from somebody called Richard Dondale. Well, Edward wasn't Richard Dondale. Edward was Edward Duncan. Except the postcard was in Edward's handwriting. And it turned out that Edward Duncan, my brother, went AWOL from the Royal Marines and joined the French Foreign Legion. And went to Corsica and learned how to speak French in 3 months. Because every time he got a word wrong, they hit him in the face with a rifle butt. Remarkable how that can help you learn a language, right? He became a legionnaire. We didn't hear from him again. 5 years of wondering whether Edward was alive or dead. And one day I was standing at our kitchen, looking out the window. It looked out into the back garden. My mother, who was a tea junkie, had said to me, "Go and make me a cup of tea." So I said, "Okay." And my big brother Edward, when he came home, always came in the back door. Never came through the front door. And I was making a cup of tea, looking out into the garden, and the back door opened, and in walked Edward. Missing for 5 years. And as he walked past me, he went, "All right, kid." And I dropped the teapot. And he went into our living room and he said to my mum, in Northern Ireland, you either call your mum and dad mommy and daddy or ma and da. And my mother was sitting in one chair and my father was sitting in the other. And he came in and he threw his bag on the floor. He said, "All right, ma. All right, da." What do you think my mother and father did? Do you think they said, "No, explain yourself"? They went berserk. My mother ran out into the street in her nightdress. And she ran up and down the street in Rathcoole and she said, "My boy's back! My boy's back!" And she came up to my brother, who is now no longer alive, and she put her hands. I will remember it until the day I die. Let me show you exactly what she did. "Pastor Scott, I'm sorry, you're going to be my example. Just stay there. Come here for a second." She turned there so they can see you. She went like this. And she touched his head. And she touched his face and she touched... Sorry, I'm not going to do that all night. You'll be all right. There is ministry available at the end for you, Scott. My father held onto his feet. Grabbed his ankles. Why? Because their boy who was dead was alive again. That's not where the story ends. I have another big brother who is now dead. And his name was Colin. And he resented Edward. So when Edward came back, Colin was raging. And you know what he said? How can you treat him like that? I've never run away. I've never abandoned you. I've stayed and looked after you. I've done everything that's right, but here he is back and you're celebrating him. And my mom and dad weren't Christians. My brothers weren't Christians. I wasn't a Christian. But I can remember reading this story for the first time and saying, this is my brother's story. This is Edward and Colin. Except my mom and dad are in it, not just my dad. This father loved his boy so much that when he saw him, he just wanted to embrace him. Do you realize that that's how much God loves you? Do you realize that he would run to you, that he would throw his arms around you, that he would kiss you, that he would put a robe on you, that he would put a ring in your finger? That's why I wear a ring in my finger. By the way, this story is why I wear a ring in my finger. This ring, I always have a ring in this finger. Occasionally, very rarely over 30-odd years, maybe 35, 37 years, two or three times, God has told me to take my ring off and give it to somebody. It happened in this church not so long ago. And I went to them and I took my ring off my finger and I said, God wants you to have this, son. And he wants you to know that you are loved. He wants you to know that he will put a ring on your finger. He will accept you. He will welcome you into his family. And this story is full of beauty and restoration. Verses 21 and 22. Father, I've sinned against you. But the father said to his slaves, bring out a robe, the best one. Put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf. In Northern Ireland terms, this says, we're having a party! Do you know why? And this is the important thing. These three stories aren't just about lostness. These three stories are about lostness, knownness, and lovedness. The sheep that went was known, counted in and counted out. You don't look for something that you don't miss. And I know, by the way, that this was an embarrassing moment. But don't worry. I know it was an embarrassing moment, but it was a parable of this message. You might not realize it, but God used your pearl rolling along that floor. Because it's the story of tonight. I couldn't have set it up. I wish I had. The coin was known. It was valued. It mattered. And the reason the father stood at the gate and waited for his son was because he loved him. You don't look for what you don't love. You don't miss what you don't love. And let me say for a moment to Christians, if you're a follower of Jesus here tonight, can we please stop talking just about lostness? In the Bible, the stories of people that were lost, they were people with a family and a name and a situation. They weren't just a notch on a belt. Jesus knew them. He took time with them. He saw them. He loved them. The church is not a factory. We are a family. And we don't simply run after people because they're breathing. They are made in the image of God. They are known by him and loved by him and missed by him. In every single church in London tonight, in every single church around the world, there's a chair with somebody's name on it. There needs to be space at our table for those that are not yet followers of Jesus. Because one day your brother or your sister might walk into a church on the other side of the world and you would want them to be welcomed, would you not? You would want them to be embraced and seen and loved. Well, if that's how you want your family and I want my family to be treated in other churches, surely that's how we treat other people when they come to our church. One of my siblings once got very drunk and went to a church on a Sunday morning after having had a difficult time because his partner had died, and they threw him out. And he never went back. What he needed was somebody to sit with him. Somebody to say, I see you. Can I help you? What a church it would be if we all took the posture of the father that was looking for the son that had gone missing. And then we come to the last section of the story. The elder brother is in the field and he comes in verse 25 and he hears the music and the dancing. And he calls one of the slaves and he says, what's happening? And the slave says, your brother, in verse 27, who was dead, is alive and has come back, and your dad's pulling a party. And I wonder, do you notice what happens in verse 28? Then he became angry and refused to go in. And his father came out and began to plead with him. The father does it again. He stood and waited for his younger son. And he ran to him when he saw him. And this time the elder brother is there, and it is the father that makes the first move again. He goes out to him and he doesn't ask him. He pleads with him to come in. He begs him to come in. And do you see how this elder brother speaks to his father in verse 29? Listen. For all these years, I've been working like a slave for you, and I've never disobeyed your command, yet you've never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours comes back, not my brother, when this son of yours come back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed a fatted calf for him. Can you hear the resentment? Can you hear the vindictiveness and the anger and the jealousy oozing out of this man? This son of yours. Not this brother of mine, this son of yours. And I've done everything. Do you know what was going on here? This elder brother believed his father was a tyrant and he didn't know who his father was. What do you think God's like? Why do you serve him? You see, the scribes and the Pharisees treated God like a tyrant. And because they treated God like a tyrant, everybody around them thought that God was a tyrant. So they were all afraid of him because that's all they saw. I can tell you the kind of God you believe in by the way you live your Christian life. Finger pointing. Demanding, condescending, legalistic, judgmental, rejecting. That's because that's what you believe God's like. And yet, when we find Jesus, we find a God who loves us, who comes to us, who embraces us, who forgives us, who welcomes us, who protects us, who provides for us, who accepts us, who restores us, who transforms us, who changes us. So why then do we think that other people need to find a legalistic God? If the God that brought you into his family is loving and gracious and kind and merciful and forgiving and restorative, then that's what he is like with everybody, not just you, not just me. This elder brother had a wrong image of God and it was changing and shaping the way he treated other people. Is it possible that the Church of Jesus Christ in Europe and in London and in North America and around the world sometimes behaves like the elder brother, rejecting people because they don't fit our mold? This resentment between the elder brother and his father boils over. You never see resentment back from the father, by the way. The elder brother returns in verse 25. Your brother, he says, in verse 27, and your father, the servants say to him, your brother and your father, verse 28 has him saying he refused to go in. So his father comes out then, verse 29, the elder brother did not understand his father's heart. this son of yours, verse 30. And how does God the Father, or how does the man in this story, the Father, respond to all of this animosity? Then the Father said to him in verse 31, Son, you are always with me. That's almost non-existent anywhere else in the New Testament. Normally, the line goes like this, I am always with you. This is almost the only place where God says, you are always with me. In other words, he is saying to this older brother, your inheritance is secure. Your destiny is sealed. You're not going to lose anything by me welcoming him back. The property that I have is yours. He says, all I have is yours. He's not going to give the son another bite at the cherry. He's telling this older brother, you're safe, you're secure, you're always with me, and all that is mine is yours. And then he says, but we had to celebrate and rejoice. And do you see the reversal? Because this brother of yours was dead and is now alive. This elder brother has just a few moments ago said, this son of yours. And the father says, no, this brother of yours. And then the story ends. No rejoicing in heaven in this story. No big end to this story. No crescendo. No trumpet blast. No Jesus saying in the same way the Father rejoices and the angels rejoice, because it's all implied. But he's looking at these scribes and Pharisees and saying, so what are you? Are you the elder brother? Or are you the younger brother? He's looking at the Jewish leadership and saying, what will you do when I start to bring the Gentiles in? Will you make room for them? And we don't know what they said. So let me ask you, the story is ended, but the finale is not yet there. What will you do? Are you an elder brother? Pastors can be elder brothers. Elders can be elder brothers. Friends and brothers and sisters can be elder brothers. You're an elder brother when you say, you threaten me, so I don't want you. I can't shine if you're here, so you're not welcome. I don't want you to change my church, so I will stop you getting in. You don't fit in around here. You're not the right face. You're not the right type. You don't have the right ideas. We don't want you. And God says back to us, is that not for me to decide? Maybe this story is so pertinent to me, not only because of Edward and Colin. Maybe it's also pertinent because of me. Because on the night that I was converted, over that weekend back in 1986, I've told you before, but you may not have made the connection just yet. God spoke to me through three words. They were changed my destiny. He said, son, come home. In London and around the world tonight, as Father's Day draws to a close, I wonder how many daughters and sons there are that need to hear God saying, darling, come home. Come home. A very famous Canadian businessman, could the musicians come back to join me? Was once a colleague of Billy Graham. And he lost his faith in the 1950s and became a very successful businessman in Canada. And not long before he died, a Christian journalist and writer in the United States of America interviewed him to try and understand what it was that caused him to leave the church. And he said, I want to write an article about you. He said, no problem, go right ahead and do that. So during the course of the interview, John Ortberg was the interviewer. And he said to this gentleman, "Tell me why you left faith." And he told him he was disillusioned with the church. He was disgruntled and disappointed by the mechanics and the structures and the politics and the posturing and all of that. He went into it all in great detail. And then John Ortberg said to him, "And how do you feel now?" And his tone changed, and the gentleman said, "Well, I'm coming to the end of my life. And I've done what I can." And John Ortberg leaned across his desk and he said to him, "And what about Jesus? What do you think about Jesus?" And this hardened businessman who had left faith 60 years before started to weep. And he said, "Jesus, I miss him very much. I think I need to stop the interview." He died not long thereafter. God is here tonight. By the power of the Holy Spirit. And he looks into every one of your souls and mine and he says, "I'm waiting at the gate. I want to welcome you back. Will you turn? Will you come to me?" And I pray that every single one of us who are followers of Jesus will adopt a posture of thanksgiving and celebration.